If you look at the outline, which is an essay form, something I dock my students for doing, it's writing essays with outline. But I had to cram it in 2 pages, so that's what happened. We're going to try to follow that, but I'm going to expand at certain points, and there's something I left out accidentally, probably providentially, that we're going to expand on particularly. My journey has been a very broad journey. As Kip mentioned, my area of expertise is ancient Near Eastern religions, including the Old Testament. But I teach theology and ethics. So I try to embrace almost the entire department of religion in some way, except I don't do New Testament anymore. I did my master's in it, but that was as far as I got. As a result, I have been experimenting for the last 4 or 5 years with making theology very real, experiential, and dynamic, because I found my students gave me about 2% recall on the exams. They basically answered from everything they knew from Sabbath school and academy, but nothing from my class. That says something about me as a teacher, but I did consult my colleagues and they assured me they had the same problem. So I began to really wrestle with how to make this real. I was frustrated with the theoretical element of theology. We are so engaged in theory. And after a while, it ceases to be real, and I came to the conclusion that we've done theology for years with our left brain and nothing with our right brain. Right brain being an area of experience, creative endeavor, and so on. So this is kind of that journey, incorporating a number of areas, including Old Testament, including the ancient Near East, as we will see. And what happened, too, is that God providentially provided me with some experiences of abuse. I won't go into that. They were varied and forced me to deal with abuse issues in my own life. The result was that one day I was working on something I have worked on for years, and I tend to do this. I raise a question in my mind, and for years I will try to fit pieces together. It's like I do giant jigsaw puzzles in my brain, and when I find a piece, I put it in the right spot, and eventually a picture begins to emerge. The picture that I was working on was, well, how could Lucifer, as we understand it, get from pride to violence? Now, we have used Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14 as examples of Lucifer's fall. That is not just an Adventist perception per se. Now, the way we talk about it is Adventist. But if you go to modern scholars who deal with cosmology, they will agree that the two kings, the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon, do seem to be somewhat supernatural. They use the term mythic to describe them. They have a non-human representation. And they do represent rebellion or a fall and so on. So I feel comfortable, even on a scholarly basis, with using them. And what I did is take these two texts along with Revelation, put them together. And as I was mapping this out, trying to follow a thought sequence, that is, as your attitudes develop and as your thinking develops, where do you end up? As I looked at this, just trying to encapsulate how a person could be so close to God and through pride come to the point of violence, I began to realize that I was looking at the sequence of an abuser. That's where this journey on abuse actually began. I then began to get excited and to go some other places, which we'll look at in just a minute. But if you look at the left-hand column, which I have entitled The Mark in the Forehead, that comes from Revelation, of course, you have pride, externalism, supremacy, control, misrepresentation, power, and violence, and then finally imaging. And I've used certain texts. I hope you can see them from where you are, where I got those. I had been actually working on this for a long time, and I'm going to bring some of those elements into bear as well. This is the left-hand column. This is the process by which a person becomes an abuser. The right-hand column is the response of the victim as the victim becomes victimized. These are unhealthy responses. And so in the process of victimization, low self-esteem, which is the result of meeting someone who's arrogant and lords it over you with their great ability. Artificiality is a result of externalism. Oppression, the result of supremacy, that is, they suffer oppression, they submit to oppression. Dependence, control always breeds dependence in the other person. And finally, misrepresentation and deception, power, submission to power, violence, victimization, and then finally, what I call imaging, which is when the process becomes societal, it becomes the norm, it becomes standard, it becomes okay, and then conformity. The reason I chose mark in the forehead and mark in the hand is I thought it was interesting, you know, that you can have the mark of the beast in two places, forehead or hand. You can either be abused or a victim and still receive the mark of the beast. The things I want to emphasize now from this are pride, externalism, and control. I'm going to start with pride. I was going to have you do something. I know you're brain weary. And I don't know, maybe I should still do it just to give you a moment of kind of relaxation, as long as you don't fall asleep on me. I'd like you to imagine yourself in a scene in your life where you feel valued. It could be as a mother, as a wife, as a person in the workplace, as a member of the church, in a social setting with your friends. Where is a place where you feel valued? Go there and ask yourself the question, why do I feel valued there? I'll give you 30 seconds to do that. What makes me feel valued there? And then I want to ask you to go to another place. Go to the most beautiful scene in nature you can imagine. Maybe a lake, might be a mountaintop, might be by the sea. Someplace where you really would love to be, and put Jesus in there. And ask yourself, what makes you valuable in that setting? Now, I don't want your answers, because those are personal. But I detect there are very healthy women in this room. The answer to your question, if it wasn't the same in both settings, either means you have arrived at perfection, or you have a problem with abuse. Pride, I have come to believe, is the misvalue of a person. Now, I know we think of pride in terms of the superlative. People who think they're the greatest, the best, the most important, and so on, and expect worship from other people. We have tended to see that as pride. I have come to the conclusion that pride is something so much more rooted in the way we see things that it is the misvalue of a person. And thus, pride includes unhealthy self-esteem and low self-esteem. That is, arrogance and denigration, self-denigration. Pride is thinking about our world and our reality and our own personal value in terms of what I call the air words, better, richer, poorer, and so on, stronger, faster, and all of the other comparatives such as weaker, slower, and so on. That is what I would call the continuum of pride. Because once I value myself in relationship, in comparison to other people, I set myself up for a false worldview that will lead me either to abuse someone else or to be abused. Now, yet already you may be kind of picking up that I believe that abuse is universal, and I do. I have come to believe that we need to call sin by its right name, and that its right name is abuse. That we are all both victims and abusers. Maybe some of us are more classically abusers, and therefore we talk about those kind of people as the abusers. But all of us, if we mistreat another person, we're abusive. And if we allow someone to mistreat us and submit to it as correct and right and bear the guilt that that brings, we are then victims of abuse. So I have come to see this as a universal problem if you push it to its logical conclusion. And I based it basically on this discovery that we're looking here at a trajectory that ultimately leads to violence. Now, violence doesn't have to be physical violence. Violence can be emotional violence. It can be verbal violence. It can be body language violence. But it leads to some form of violence. I want to talk about pride on a different vein, too. And this has to do with our personal value. We tend to view value in terms of our production in our society, in terms of our workload, in terms of how efficient we are, how capable we are, how competent we are, and so on. Our whole society is this way. You know, you go to church on Sabbath morning and you hear all about grace and how wonderful grace is and how we don't have to earn our way to heaven. But during the week, we sure have to earn our way to hell. It seems that we have not internalized the gospel on a practical level. That we're still very works-oriented when it comes to our day-to-day relationships. The Bible really gives only two reasons why we are valuable. And those two reasons are reasons for every single person on the planet. That is, we are valuable because we are created in the image of God with the power to think and to do. And we are valuable because He redeemed us through Jesus Christ. Those are the two reasons we're valuable. Those are the only two reasons we need to establish our basic value. And once we do, we can develop a powerful sense of personal control that allows us to give other people room and not feel threatened by them. And we can stop our little power games that we often engage in. So it's all about value. The bottom line, in my opinion, for dealing with abuse is about value, human value, personal value. I want to go to externalism, and we'll be talking about that extensively in a moment. I got this from the text in Ezekiel 28. You corrupted your wisdom because of your bright splendor. I wondered what that meant. Doesn't God like beauty? I think bright splendor is probably the NRSV translation. Other translations may have beauty in there. Doesn't God like brightness and splendor and beauty? Wasn't He the one who dressed the king of Tyre out? He decked him out with jewelry. You read Ezekiel 28. So God must like splendor and beauty. So what's wrong with what happened here? Well, what happened was that I believe the king of Tyre exchanged his internal locus of control for an external locus of control. That is, he became more preoccupied with how he looked, with his image, his outward perception, than he was with his own wisdom and his own internal powers of thought. If you translate that as a principle, that is fundamentally the basis of abuse. Everything in our society that curbs another person's own freedom, their own personal choices, their ability to develop as individuals is abuse. This means it's much more embedded in our society than we ever realize. That whatever we do to attempt to in the moral sphere, for example, to create morality externally without an internal sense of what morality is and without internalization of moral principles is not morality. It's an externalization of that. And I'm going to explain this in a minute when I talk about society. I would like to move to control because I'm amazed at how little people understand the nature of abuse. One of the hallmarks of abuse and one of the chief features is that of control. Abusers are all about controlling other people. Now, once again, if my locus of control is now external instead of internal, I am out of control internally to the extent that I try to control you externally. I don't know if I made that clear. I am out of control internally to the extent that I try to control you externally. That is, as I lose control internally, I have little self-control, I will think you are to blame for any troubles that I have, and I will try to control you to control my external environment. You are my external environment. And more than that, my control of you is attempting to control you externally from the outside in. External control is about controlling someone from the outside in. Internal control is controlling someone from the inside out. And that's only what we can do individually. I next went to the Garden of Eden, and I looked at the story of Adam and Eve in a different way. You know how we usually pick out key texts out of that story. I looked at it as an actual experience with a deceptive serpent. Because the story is about deception. And when Adam and Eve ate the fruit of the tree, it was not about disobedience. It was about a complete change of reality. Adam and Eve changed their perceptions of reality as a result of that experience, particularly Eve. And what I've done here, and I'm not going to go through this, I don't have time, but what I have done here is gone step by step through what the serpent says, to attempt to show how he, number one, is abusing Eve by how he handles the conversation. He's manipulating her, he's exploiting her, he is engaging her in a mind game where he twists the truth. And onto the right-hand side, I attempt to show how he then takes his own personal abuse and reflects it on God, so that Eve doesn't see the serpent as abusing her, she sees God as the one who's abusing her. That changes her whole orientation, her whole perspective of a reality. Reality is no longer what it used to be. Her perceptions of God are not what they used to be. And she now is thinking completely in a different paradigm. She's made a complete paradigm shift in terms of her understanding of reality. What happens then when she decides that God is the abuser? You follow through the story. It's really about what happens when people become victimized. She eats the fruit because of the external appeal. The external fruit has power over her to change her mind. She has now developed externalism. She's now letting something externally to her control her internally. That is the basis of all substance abuse. Something externally has the power to make me happy, give me highs, pull me out of the ditch, I can forget about my troubles, whatever. Addiction is all about externalism, having something outside of me control me. And that's why I use the actual term that it was addictive to the eyes. That's very interpretive, that's not Hebrew. However, if you look at the verb, it does have an edge toward that. The tree was desirable for understanding. Means that it was controlled, that she could be controlled and manipulated by external and magical forces. The whole idea of magic is built upon this kind of externalism. And she ends up sharing her deception with her husband, spreading her codependency. And her reality changes. She now sees the other side. This becomes now a kind of state of paranoia. And it has left her, when they find that they are naked, by the way, they're naked all along. The Bible says so. when they find they're naked, it's a matter of partly perception and partly loss. They are stripped of their personhood and they attempt to compensate with fig leaves. So when they hear the voice or the sound of God, let me translate it either way, walking in the garden, they keep themselves hidden. That's denial, hiding from false perceptions, reaction to a belief that God is abusive. And they hide themselves from the face of God. Victims of abuse cannot look into people's faces easily. The result is fear. They're afraid now of God. And furthermore, they start blaming one another. So the victimization goes through the process all the way to blaming, which is one of its outcomes. I just want to point out one thing here. When God handles the situation, he does a series of reality checks, trying to bring them into reality. They elude reality, they evade it, he then promises that someone will come who will break the cycle of abuse at its source, the mind. This is, for me, very, very personal. In my own journey with abuse, just last Sabbath, a friend of mine and I took a walk along a beach, and she brought me through a sequence of understanding about what I needed to do about my situation that was so revealing that I really felt the serpent's head being crushed. I mean, I felt that release and freedom that I hadn't felt in a long time. So this is very personal and real. This is not just about something abstract on a piece of paper that we tend to think of. This is something that actually happens to people, and what Jesus came to do was to do that. What I want to talk about now is something that for me is I could write a whole book on alone. This is part of my doctoral journey. And that is how society became abusive. If you really study the story out as it occurs in the ancient Near East, particularly Mesopotamia, it goes something like this. Originally, human beings had created a family-based, interdependent society. Something like the American Indians, where everybody was needed in order to provide food for everyone's existence. And the main goal was survival and relationships. Now, of course, the original society God intended to have happen was that of love. Love is service-oriented, it is giving, it is unselfish. That can only happen when the internal locus of control is intact and one has a true sense of their own personal value. As long as society had those kinds of relationships, they could be fruitful and multiply, live in families, live very successfully, very happily. But of course, as we know, because of sin, society began to break down. And what seems to have happened is that a group of people came up the Persian Gulf and bumped into an alluvial land where they found that along the Euphrates River they could actually grow crops. And so they settled down and began to grow crops. Well, in order to grow crops in that very arid region, they had to dig canals. In fact, canals were invented there in Mesopotamia. Digging canals in Iraq, you can imagine, is very hot work and very hard work. And as near as I can tell, and I've based this on the myths that I have studied in Mesopotamia, human beings became very weary of doing this for one another. And probably there was quarreling, there was fighting, and other things began to break out, all symptoms of a breakdown of this model of love. And some people found that they had natural ability to stay out of the hot sun by being bosses of those who had to work in the hot sun. And so they developed a kind of boss kind of leadership. This is a divergence from a family model. And so in their their leadership role, they kind of made sure that the other people had to do their work, and they were rather harsh on them. And one day, there was a revolt. I'm basing this on the creation story, Atrahasis. The workers burned their hoes and picks and whatever they were using as implements, and created weapons and surrounded the house of their boss. And they were going to wipe him out or at least revolt. And his assistant woke him up and told him what was happening. And he came out and he said, "What can we do to help you? We better do something." And in the myth, this is all transferred to the gods, the realm of the gods. The gods create human beings to be slaves, to take the worker gods' places so that they can do the hard work. But in reality, what apparently happened is that they decided some people could be slaves. Well, how do you decide that? Well, somebody owes a debt. We make them work to pay it off. Debt slavery is not considered to be the earliest form of slavery, but it certainly started very early on. The other form of slavery was war slaves. And war began out of a divergence of human value. I want to go back now to what happened as they began to build their society. This is actually the rudiments of civilization, as civilization began. Civilization began when we discovered economics. Economics is very simple. I have two cows and you have three sheep. I'll trade you one of my cows for two of your sheep. Sounds good, doesn't it? If we're friends, we love one another, trade-off seems good. There's a subtle problem, however. Do two sheep equal one cow? No, but we can assume that they do. I mean, it's the closest value system we can have, so we'll make the trade. But that is a bit artificial. And as we developed a kind of way of making fake transactions, so to speak, we began to lose our sense of reality. Another thing that happened is that some people had more cows than others. And that meant that they were richer than others. And pretty soon it became more important to own more than your neighbor because that gave you greater status, greater power, greater influence. And as that continued on, eventually it wound up that, you know, really, people are something like oxen, aren't they? We can own them too. And what you have in society is really the devaluing of a human being, what I call objectification. We become objects. Instead of being persons with individuality, the power to think and to do, whose model of operation is love, we now become objects to compete against, to climb up over, and to even own, as one would own a cow. As we developed that, we found out that there was a problem. Some people couldn't be trusted to get wealth fairly and squarely, and all kinds of abuses began to creep in. So we had to develop a way to externally control that. That became known as law. And it may surprise you that the earliest laws we have in the ancient world did not come from a concern for morality as much as from a concern for economics. In fact, the precursor of ancient laws were economic reforms. I could give you the name of a very ancient king, but it's very hairy to pronounce, and I'll spare you. But his reforms were the first step, at least that we have in terms of documentation, the first step behind the laws that we have that precede, by the way, the biblical laws. So economics produced law, and law produced then the need for court cases. Actually, it was the other way around. Court cases also produced law. We had to settle things at the city gate. We had to arbitrate. things got increasingly more focused on what was legal than what was really of human value. And so the farther removed along that trajectory, the more the external locus of control took place. Another thing that was the result of this kind of adventure that we call civilization was that of kingship. Apparently, the story goes something like this. There were some Gudians, a tribe of people that lived in the hills that looked down on the Sumerians, the earliest people in Mesopotamia, and got jealous of all their wealth. Either that, we don't have documentation of this, but the thought occurred to me, it's possible the Sumerians made raids on the Gudians and took some of their people and their cows and so on. We don't know. But at any rate, what we do know is that the Gudians decided one day to swoop down on Sumerian villages and take their wealth. War actually began, and I think this is history. We all know that war is economic in base. But war began as a means of plunder to gain wealth. It wasn't just the booty that people brought home, which, by the way, I don't know if you remember the Song of Deborah. In the Song of Deborah, Sisera's mother looks out through the lattice in the window, and she waits for Sisera to return from battle, and she dreams of all the glorious things she's going to get, all the silk and what have you that she's going to acquire from the booty. That was war, but it wasn't just that. Once you conquered a nation, if they surrendered to you, you got their money through tribute. They became your vassal. So it was important then to make the conquest victorious. So when the Sumerians were attacked, they needed a leader to lead them into war. Otherwise, they were not efficient as war troops. That leader originally was called a hero, and he was supposed to melt back into society when he was through warring after he came home. Well, some myths indicate that there was some reluctance to melt back. I mean, all that glory, after parading around with all the captives and all the booty, and everybody patting you on the back and telling you how wonderful you were and good for you winning the war, how can you just melt back into ordinary life and be an ordinary citizen in the gate? So a shift began to take. There came to be a reluctance to move back into the shadows and ascertaining of power. And eventually, those who were chosen to lead the battles made bargains. If I win this war, you've got to make me supreme over the city-state. And as a result of that, we have the development of kingship. Now, once you have kingship, you have really decidedly shifted from family. Depending on how you see family, of course. If you see the father of the home as the king of the family, well, then we haven't shifted too far. But I think that came later. I don't think the father was originally supposed to be king. You have shifted from family, of relationships of love and trust, to relationships of power and supremacy. And once you have someone, a human being, on top of everybody else, telling everybody else what to do, and having the reins of control, you then have people below deprived of something of their freedom, their autonomy, their ability to choose and think for themselves. So kingship, in a sense, put the last part up of this new civilization that we created that devalues human beings. And it led to all kinds of problems because, you see, once you move from a model of love and trust and freedom to a model of power, you move to systemic abuse. In other words, society became systemically abusive. It became the norm, it became the right thing to do, it just became the way to have civilization. The problem is, like the Mesopotamians, we have been very good at taking our human models and planting them on God. And the Mesopotamians were really good at that. That's why I use the myths so heavily, To describe this, because the myths about the gods are really stories about human beings. He's transported them to the gods. And everything you see in terms of the Babylonian pantheon, you also see in human life. So that's what happens. And I want to move, and as a result, this may seem a little new to you, but I like to approach the Ten Commandments from a very different perspective than we have generally. Because I have come to conclude that the language is prescriptive, which is external. By prescriptive, I mean you should not. Don't do that. That's prescriptive language. But the heart of the Ten Commandments is not prescriptive, but descriptive. That is, the heart of the commandments is, this is how things really are. This is how things really work. It came to me that commandment number one really is a prescriptive statement of a principle that is so real that psychologists can tell us that without it, we die. And that is that no human being can love apart from being loved. One of the things that I had to learn in my journey, I had the dubious privilege of teaching philosophy of religion, and we have a philosophy teacher here. She was introduced from Walla Walla. She stepped out, okay. I don't like teaching philosophy because Hebraic thought is about as far removed from Greek philosophy as you can get. And it was just straddling the fence a little too far for me. But I really wrestled with some of the logical theories that were purported by different philosophers through time with my class, and I began to realize before I got through teaching that quarter that the whole problem with philosophy is that it lacked experience. It's pure logic devoid of human experience. And you can reason anything in pure logic, and it doesn't necessarily work out in human experience. And one of the things that I noticed philosophers left out of their equation when they talked about the existence of God was the love of God. Now, they talk about it in terms of theodicy, and the question, of course, in theodicy is how can a loving God allow for all the suffering? But they don't talk about it in terms of God's existence. So I began to toy with that. Well, God blessed me with a social work major who was an older student in one of my ethics classes who wrote an interesting review of Joseph Fletcher. I make my students read Joseph Fletcher because he's the father of situation ethics, and I want them to have a kind of historical continuity about situation ethics. She pointed out that the problem with Joseph Fletcher's belief is that he assumed that you could take children and tell them simply to do the loving thing, they'd know what that was. Well, how are they going to know what that is, she's asked, if they've never experienced love? And then she told her personal experience. At the age of 14, she was kicked out of the streets of San Francisco and forced to live among the homeless. She had had some religious background at a Lutheran school. And she said, I did not do as the people around me did. I did not steal. I did not manipulate. I did not do all the corrupt things they did because I had been taught the Ten Commandments. I had been taught something about what love does. I had experienced something of love. And then she said, love cannot be taught, cannot be commanded, cannot be described. It can only be experienced. That's the most powerful statement I've ever had from a student. It completely revolutionized my thinking about God, about theology, and about life. I knew, psychologists have pointed out for years, that infants who aren't loved die. In fact, I had a friend of mine come up to me after I did a seminar on this topic who said that there was an Adventist woman running an orphanage overseas. I don't remember which country. And the babies were dying. They were dying one by one, and she was very troubled because they were feeding them, they were diapering them, they were doing all the things you do with babies. And finally she went to her knees and she said, God, why are my babies dying? And he immediately said, the question came to her, are they being loved? She checked it out. Sure enough, the nurses were so busy, they weren't taking time to cuddle the infants, to coo at them, to hold them tight, and they were being deprived of the very essential of life. So here we have a law that works as a descriptive law. We love only to the extent that we have been loved. This is experiential. This is not theoretical. I can't go into my classrooms, tell my students what love is, and expect them the next day to act it out. If they haven't been modeled love, if they haven't received love, if they aren't still receiving love, they are not going to be able to love adequately. They may be able to facade it, they may be able to pretend, but only to the extent that they've been truly loved are they capable of loving another human being. And 1 John 4:19 really states that in so many words. We love because He first loved us. I think that's why we're not to have any other gods before God. If we have anyone other than the supreme lover of the universe, we are shortchanging ourselves, we are cutting ourselves off from life. We are then keeping ourselves from the ultimate experience of love. Now, of course, God uses people to love us. He used our parents first and foremost to be in His place to us. But ultimately, if we have another person in our lives other than the God of love, we are cutting ourselves off from love. Now, I want to make one other statement. This has to do with abuse. An abuser who really is what we would call a typical abuser, the one we would classify sociologically as an abuser, is a person who wants to be as God. They want to convince you that they are omnipotent, that they are omniscient, and they are omnipresent. Now, this is pushing them to the extreme. Most abusers aren't that far along, but given enough time to really develop, that's where they go. That means when you surrender to them and let them abuse you and submit to it and allow them to deprive you of your freedom and your individuality, you are putting another God before you. That's how important this is. So that's why a healthy, you may have to endure abuse, but you should not submit to it. There is a difference. Jesus endured the cross, but He despised the shame. He did not submit internally to it as though it were right. The second commandment, I think, typifies a principle that is also in the New Testament, that by beholding we become changed. And this is the other side of the same coin as we love because He first loved us. Role modeling. We become like what we focus on, what we see in action. I learned more about how to drive my car by watching my parents drive than I did by being handed a manual on how to drive my car. Just observation, role modeling. It's a very important key element to dealing with abuse. And I go through the entire commandments. I'm going to spend a little bit of time on the Sabbath because I'm finding that in terms of the ancient Near Eastern culture and mindset, the Sabbath has become, to me, exceedingly precious in terms of abuse. The ancient Babylonians believed that they were created to be slaves of the gods. That was their only reason for being. And the gods were kings, as it were, especially the chief god that they worshipped was a king, and they were his subjects, or better yet, his slaves. So in Babylonia, you had evil days. These were not Sabbath days. These were days where you had to be careful not to offend your God. And consequently, there was no time in slavery for rest. Now, in my opinion, slavery is the ultimate abuse, other than murder. Because in slavery, somebody owns you, lock, stock, and barrel. They have deprived you of your individuality and your freedom completely. So, given that they were slaves of the gods, slaves never rest. They always have to provide for their masters. Consequently, the Babylonians never rested. It was only the gods that had the chance to rest. It's in light of that that the Sabbath makes so much more sense. Because God reminds Israel that He created them. That's the basis of their value. More than that, He created them in His image. And that everybody, every laboring thing was to grasp with God. Do you realize the equality that that brings everybody into? And he specifically states your manservant and your maidservant, your ox and your ass. Even the animals were to rest. Why? Why would he elevate the animals? Well, how much abuse has gone on in the animal world? What was God's original plan? Was it not that we were to be the caregivers to the animal world that he is to us? And how have we flipped that on its head? So it's really, Sabbath is really the strongest anti-slavery law you can find in the Bible. It means that we are not slaves of God, that rather we fellowship with him on a level with him that is just unheard of in the ancient Near East. I discovered one early morning when I couldn't sleep, I began musing on the Ten Commandments. And as I thought about them, I thought, you know, there aren't Ten Commandments. There's more than that. Of course, I knew that in the Hebrew Bible, they're never called Ten Commandments. They're only called Ten Words. Now, one scholar thought that that meant they really were originally Ten Words, Ten literal words. And so he has an article that was published. It's explaining how they could have originally been one word per commandment. I don't know, his way of dealing with, remember the Sabbath day was really difficult, but he managed to stretch it. I don't find that necessary, considering the Hebrew word means more than just word. It can mean matter, thing, subject, topic for discussion. I personally think it could mean articles of a constitution. The ten words are ten sections that we call the Ten Commandments. So I got out my Hebrew Bible and I started counting the imperatives. The imperatives is the grammatical form for command. And I came down to seven imperatives that had to do with our relationship with God. And then I went down the other side, seven imperatives that had to do with our relationship with human beings. And I said, whoa, there's something going on here. There's a literary structure developing. So I began to examine them as parallels, and sure enough, I came to conclude that our relationship with human beings is dynamically related to our relationship with God. So you have at the top there, you shall have no other gods against my face, which is what the Hebrew literally says. Value your father and your mother. Well, if parents stand in the place of God with their children, to the extent that we honor them, we are capable, perhaps, of understanding who God is, providing our parents don't misrepresent him grossly. You shall not murder. You might wonder what that has to do with not making an image or an idol. If you go to Genesis 9:6, the earliest law in the Old Testament regarding murder states that the reason why capital punishment is to be enforced for murderers is because in the image of God, God created human beings. What does that mean? It means that murder is the destruction of the image of God. It means it's much broader than just physically killing someone. But once a person has managed to physically kill another human being, they have, in a sense, murdered themselves first. We know that from psychological evidence today. There is a midbrain response in almost every animal in creation against killing their own kind. A person has to be either trained to kill their own kind, bypassing that midbrain response, or that midbrain response has to be destroyed in some way. Sociopaths have that response destroyed. So, in order for a murder to take place, the murderer must first have had the image of God destroyed in them to a great extent. Now, that's not to say that murderers are going to be lost. Necessarily, look at David and some other key players in the Old Testament. What it means is that there is a definite connection between how we treat one another in terms of valuing their lives and how we see the image of God. And the image of God in that human, if we come to devalue them, to destroy the image of God in them in our perceptions, the next step will be to murder them. You shall not bow down to them as religion. You shall not commit adultery. I thought this was a fascinating one in terms of Hebraic language. Hebrew is very concrete. It gives you a picture. I could give you a few that you would find rather amazing, actually. In this case, it's prostration. If bowing down to an idol is a kind of giving myself to that idol without legitimacy, without a complete relationship of love and trust, without that idol being worthy of my giving myself to them, that's prostration. And the same thing happens in adultery. So there's a correlation between those two in terms of values, in terms of perceptions. And then this is one that's a little harder. You shall not serve them, and you shall not steal. It really isn't hard if you realize that stealing has to do with this economic valuing system. And that service has to do with slavery, which was the byproduct of ancient economics as it developed early on. Finally, this one is very easy. You shall not devalue Yahweh's name. Treat it lightly, take it in vain, and you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, we tend to think of this as you shall not lie, but it's very explicit. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor means you shall not, in the city gate, bear false testimony when they're being tried. So, what these commandments suggest is that to the extent we have a healthy relationship with God, we are capable of having healthy relationships with one another, and likewise, if we have healthy relationships with one another, we are very more likely to have a healthy relationship with God. Which means that an abused child is at great risk not to be able to develop a healthy relationship with God. And people who are spiritually abused are not likely to have healthy relationships with one another. I want to talk a little bit about spiritual abuse. This is a partial bibliography of books I found helpful. The one by David Johnson and Jeff Van Vonderen, The Subtle Power of Spiritual Abuse, is a book I would recommend to all of you. We talk about sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical abuse, but I would like to talk about spiritual abuse. Because I think that if there's anything we as a church need to deal with, it is spiritual abuse. Spiritual abuse is using God as a weapon to control other people. It is using Him to get people under our thumb, so to speak, to control them. And it's becoming a really strong way of dealing with religion. I cringe over altar calls sometimes. I know we don't have them so much anymore on the West Coast, but I have a feeling they're going to start coming back in, and sometimes they seem so manipulative. I felt that way even as a child when I was subjected to them. They were a means of control. There's only one altar call I ever witnessed in my entire life that I did not feel controlled by, and I really felt the Spirit led the particular speaker, who was a woman, by the way, to give the altar call. But in The Subtle Power of Spiritual Abuse, these two people, one is a pastor, the other is a psychologist, counselor, also a pastor, have teamed together their ideas, their perspectives, theologically and psychologically, to talk about spiritual abuse. Another term for spiritual abuse could be theological abuse. We can actually have a theology that institutionalizes the principles of abuse as appropriate and make a very healthy church as a result. Are there any questions? I got through with this a little faster than I expected.
I just wanted to know, on that altar call you mentioned, what were the elements that made you feel comfortable and non-manipulated? Repeat the question.
Okay, the question is, what were the elements in the altar call that I did not feel threatened by or did not feel uncomfortable with that made it seem non-abusive? Now you're asking me to remember, and I'm trying to do that. My recollection is that she started out by saying, you know, this was a person in concert, by the way. She was a musician, and she was singing. She said, I don't normally do this, but I really feel that I should tonight. I feel impressed. And it was her tone of voice, her facial expression, her very attitude. There was an openness that if you don't come forward, I'm not going to love you any less. You're not condemned by me if you don't come forward, but I want to warmly invite you to come.
Freedom of choice.
Freedom of choice. I once had a week of prayer overseas. The college that I taught at, it was Hong Kong Adventist College. And we had students ranging from ages 11 to 22 at that week of prayer, middle school and the college. And that was a real challenge for me that week, to try to make it interesting to all levels with a translator on top of it. At the end of the week, I had been through many weeks of prayer at that particular college. This was the last one I was there teaching. I'd been there 3 years. And I was sick of the altar calls that used to be given because there was so much pressure on kids. It was like there was only one road, and if you didn't get on that one road, you're condemned. And I had had students who had resisted Adventism for 9 years. Resisted every altar call because they just didn't like being manipulated like that. And the common knowledge was that middle schools were supposed to be places where that's where they gathered the souls in the conference. So they had hundreds of baptisms every year coming in, and as soon as the students would graduate from Form 6, they were gone from the church. So the back door swung as wide open as the front door, and that's how the conference kept their records. More with the front door than the back door. Well, it was pretty sad to me, and so I decided to do something very unusual. I passed out a piece of paper for them to mark which one they wanted, and it was gradated all the way up to Bible studies and baptism. The first one was, I do not want to have anything to do with God. That was choice number one. And I remember as I explained it to these kids, them sitting there in absolute shock that I would ever do a thing like that. You mean I have a choice to say no? Of course you have a choice to say no. And that's, to me, a non-manipulative approach. I'm very uncomfortable with manipulating people to be converted. Any other questions? Yes?
I noticed in here too, with the mark on the forehead and the mark on the hand, that you link pride to violence in one column, and yet in the victimized column there isn't any violence, a link to violence. And Rene Girard talks about mimetic desire, and that violence comes out of rivalry. And I was wondering how you would discuss the absence of violence in the victimized column.
I didn't finish my paradigm. I was working to get through. The bottom here in conformity leads to the top.
Sure.
What happens with the victim is that when they reach the level of conformity, and possibly even before, the level of victimization would work as well, they become the next abuser. Go ahead, Heather. It would be, yes, because if you include low self-esteem as part of the pride, they've accepted the label, but they want to reject it, but they use the same principles of rejection that their abusers have used. Because they're still in that paradigm.
But you think it's like consciously like accessible to people who are living in the abusive system? That they can consciously understand this information coming to them?
Not in this way. Not in this way, because this is a process personally where a person has to grow step by step. And where you have to start is not by going backwards up the scale. You have to cut to the chase and go back to the human value thing and deal with that. You have to empower them from within. Yes?
Gina, when I know you love Ella White very much, but your definition of spiritual abuse as using God as a weapon to control other people immediately brings her to mind. Would you please repeat the question?
Okay. The question that Bonnie has raised is, doesn't this thing about spiritual abuse bring Ellen White to mind? And I would say emphatically, yes. The way the church has used her, the way we have used her throughout our whole history as a weapon to keep young people in line, definitely is spiritual abuse. But we've done the same thing with God, so it doesn't mean that the core is not valid. It simply means that we have been very abusive in the way we serve. Well, I tend to believe that let me use a biblical example. If you look in Genesis, there's not a single instance in which God is angry. That's something that most people don't know. In fact, I happen to send my students on a chase to try to find the wrath of God in Genesis. They always tell me, oh, it's in the flood, or it's in Sodom and Gomorrah, and so on. Now, you could construe some text to mean that God is being placated in terms of his anger, but there is no place in connection with the stories, the most violent of stories, that God is angry. In fact, it tends to be less until you get to the time period of the kings. Now, I have studied ancient Near Eastern literature. In fact, I have a good anthology by Benjamin Foster called Before the Muses, in which he does a historical evaluation of all the Akkadian literature that's been published, or at least the most important Akkadian literature that's been published. And if you sit down and read that anthology, in the early periods, the gods aren't angry. It's as kingship develops and increases in power, and conquest comes into play, and people become more and more dominated, and society loses its value system, you then have the gods become increasingly angry. And I maintain the same trajectory is found in the Old Testament. So that it is the result of this whole devaluing system with kingship and external values that leads to the perception that God is angry and has to be appeased. So you come to 1844, and the general perception is that there's all of these, slightly Puritan view of God. And the question is, how fast can you lead people out of that? And I think the very reason that God inspired human beings, not dictated words, is because he wanted the human element there to be closer to where the people were. So I see Ellen as, if you read her historically, she develops. I think that was first pointed out by Alden Thompson years ago. So I see the same thing happening, basically, in a different direction, perhaps. Now, it's true, the older she got, the more she seemed to revert to the other language. I don't know if that would be age figuring in, or if it would be simply that she surrendered to the church after 1888, eventually gave up the fight. I don't know. But I had my own personal journey of wrestling with Ellen. I wrestled with her for 9 years. God did. But you know, in my wrestling, I had to learn how to reinterpret, use totally different hermeneutic methods than I had been taught. Yeah. We hope we don't do that anymore. Any other questions? Thank you.